The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I'm Stephanie Nadoff. I'm a longtime and very proud member of the board of this great institution. It's my real pleasure to introduce pioneering Penn psychologist Angela Duckworth. She began her groundbreaking research with a question, a rather straightforward one: why do some people succeed and others fail? Her experience teaching seventh grade public school math, plus reams of research that she did, led her to the theory that a child's character is a better indicator of success than IQ or family income. Her work illuminating grit, which she defines as perseverance and passion for long-term goals, has transformed the education landscape in just a few years, and as many of you know, earned her a MacArthur Genius Grant. Her new book, Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance, which just came out 2 days ago, this is one of her first appearances after the book came out, follows teachers in some of our toughest schools, as well as fledgling West Point cadets and professional high achievers, to illustrate Grit's life-changing influence. Best-selling author and social scientist Dan Heath praises her with, "This book will change your life. Fascinating, rigorous, and practical, Grit is destined to become a classic in the literature of success." Pretty high praise. That's great. Her talk tonight will be in conversation with Jane Golden. Many of you know her, another icon in our city. She's the founder and executive director of the Great Philadelphia Mural Arts Program. We're so pleased to have both of them here today. So, ladies and gentlemen, will you help me welcome Angela Duckworth and Jane Golden? Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here. And thank you, Jane, for doing this. This is going to be so fun. It's really an honor to be here. I live two blocks away, depending on how you count, and I wrote this book two blocks away, and so it's really an honor and a privilege. I think that it's more fun to have a conversation than to deliver a monologue, so I'm going to go through some of my slides and maybe set the foundation for that conversation, but I think the dialogue that Jane and I have together about what it's like to be a paragon of grit, as I would call Jane, an exemplar of passion for what you do and lifelong perseverance in pursuit of excellence, that would be a more fun way to spend time, I think, than just hearing me say things about what I think grit is. And then maybe most fun of all, Jane and I would love to hear your questions, and so we'll reserve the last part of the hour for that. I study grit using a questionnaire a lot of the time, and I want to tell you where this questionnaire came from, and I want to read you a couple of items. First, let me do the reading. There are even-numbered items on this questionnaire, like number 4. I am a hard worker, and right now, even in this room, you can think about where you are on the scale. Very, very hard worker, not at all a hard worker, somewhere in between. You don't have to tell anybody either if you don't want to. Number 6, I finish whatever I begin. That is the single most predictive item on the entire scale. I finish whatever I begin. Bill Gates recently confessed that he has a very bad habit, and that is that he's an inveterate reader, and that when he picks up a book, no matter how he feels about it, he is compelled to finish it. And if he would ever answer my email, I would say, "Dear Bill, it's actually not such a bad habit after all, because a bias towards completion, a bias towards finishing what you begin rather than leaving it half-finished is actually characteristic of some of the most successful people in the world, including grit paragons like Jane and others. So that's the perseverance half of grit. And not only these items, but others, but I think you get a sense of it. Really hard work and resilience in the face of adversity. But it's only half. And when I speak to well-intentioned but stressed-out parents who are trying to get their kids to Harvard at any cost, they miss the other half of grit, and that's passion. I've never interviewed someone who was truly world-class in what they do, who didn't say in the first 5 minutes, "I love what I do. I love what I do." And so being interested intrinsically in what you do and finding it infinitely purposeful, meaningful, and important, this too is important to grit. I'll read you some of these items, and I should prepare you for this. They're reverse-coded, so if you nod your head and say, "Woo, that's just like me," you actually get a lower grit score. So these are items like number 3. I often set a goal but later choose to pursue a different one. I have difficulty maintaining my focus on projects that take more than a few months to complete. My interests change from year to year. If you said, "Wow, that's just like me," then Jane Golden might say, "You're a short-termer. You're one of those people who comes, leaves, and does something else." And she also doesn't really understand you. So this combination of passion and perseverance, what can I tell you about it? Well, here's grit scores as a function of age. Here are the millennials. And if you get Social Security, you're kind of on this end, and you don't have to tell anybody where you are on this. But in general, I find that grit and age go hand in hand. And this week I had an opportunity to write an essay for CNN, and it was called "What's Wrong with Millennials?" I got a lot of hate mail from millennials, actually. But I don't think they really read the essay. You know, they're millennials, so of course they didn't read the essay. They had to, like, tweet me back before they even read the essay. But really, the article was a defense of millennials, and here's why. When you look at data like this, and you're maybe on this end of the age spectrum, you might shake your head and say, "I knew it. Those millennials don't know how to work hard. They weren't raised to believe that it takes years of determination to get anywhere in life. You know, they resent taking their work home over the weekend." Well, you have to remember that millennials differ from older adults in two ways. It's true that millennials grew up in the new millennium, hence their name. And it's true that they grew up with Instagram and Snapchat and Pirate's Booty and things that you didn't have when you were growing up. And maybe they didn't grow up with people telling them that hard work is the secret to success and there are no shortcuts. Okay, so culture is one possible explanation for this. These folks grew up in a different culture than these folks. But there's a second explanation, and this is the explanation that has more support from scientific evidence, particularly studies where you follow people not in a snapshot like this, but like in a movie, where you ask them the same questions over time and you see how they develop. And this is what the data say. In general, people get better. You get more emotionally stable, more conscientious, more self-controlled, more dependable. My favorite is that you get nicer. You actually get nicer with age, wiser. And grit seems to fit the pattern of all these other personality traits that psychologists would collectively call the maturity principle. So if you shake your head at a 26-year-old in your office who doesn't seem to work the way you want them to, you might remember that you have twice, possibly three times as much life experience as that millennial. And it may be that the problem with millennials is that they haven't grown up yet. Give them time. Now, many of us are interested in accelerating maturation. I am. I've got a 13 and a 14-year-old, and I think maturity would be great, and could it come sooner, please? And in particular, I would like to cultivate with some intention their capacity for passion and their capacity for perseverance. seamlessly we are doing a little video switch in the back here because we really want you to hear what Will Smith has to say about success. Will Smith, native to Philadelphia, he is asked in this very short little clip, why are you so successful? Let's hear what he has to say.
The only thing that I see that is distinctly different about me is I'm not afraid to die on a treadmill. Right? I will run.
You would not be outworked.
I will not be outworked.
Right.
Period.
Yeah.
You know, you might have more talent than me. You might be smarter than me. You might be sexier than me. You might be all of those things. You got it on me in 9 categories. But if we get on the treadmill together, right, there's 2 things. You're getting off first,
yeah,
or I'm going to die. It's really that simple.
So let me tell you how gritty I am. I have been trying to get in touch with Will Smith forever. I have sent emails over the transom. I got really close. I got to his lawyer. I got to his agent. And I know his manager is named Miguel. And I know that Will's filming in New York. And I am this close. But the reason I'm so fascinated with Will is because he's saying something that is profoundly true. Somebody else said it first, and that is Francis Galton, who in 1869... Oh, by the way, if you're just coming in and you're standing, you could just, like, it won't bother me if you wander around and look for a seat, just saying, but like you could also stand. Okay, in 1869, Sir Francis Galton conducted the first systematic scientific study of high achievers. And after reviewing the biographies of great artists and musicians, athletes, he said the truly eminent have ability combined with zeal and with the capacity for hard labor. So yes, talent, but also passion and perseverance. Galton had a slightly better known cousin named Charles Darwin, who read the study and hastened to write this letter back. He said, "My dear Francis, you've made a convert in a sense, for I have always maintained that men did not differ much in intellect, but only in their zeal and hard work." Then Darwin concedes the point. He says, "You've convinced me that talent has some small role to play in the equation of achievement." But he closes the letter, "I still believe that zeal and hard work make the most important difference." And that brings me to the study of grit. Here is my theory of achievement. I think talent does matter, and here's why. Some of you, if you think of a particular skill like cooking or math, or tennis, some of you get better at one of those things really, really fast. Compared to other people, you learn more quickly and more easily. And therefore, I can say you're more talented. But if you don't do anything with that talent, if you don't try to do something with that talent for mathematics or for cooking, you still don't develop skill. So effort is important because it unlocks talent. It turns talent into actual skill. But skill's still not enough. What if you become a really great writer and you stop writing? What if you're a really great chef, but you don't cook anymore? Skill needs effort again because effort takes skill and turns it into tangible, real achievement. Talent does count, but in the equation of achievement, effort counts twice. Let me bring you all the way up to 2016. What do we know about world-class eminent individuals as of today based on science? This is a graph that summarizes the work of my good friend and my collaborator, Anders Ericsson. He's a psychologist at Florida State University, and he studies experts. I like to think of Anders as the world expert on world experts. He goes to the Sudoku Championship. He studies World Cup soccer players. He studies Nobel Prize-winning scientists. What is he after? He's after the universal laws of learning. And here's what he's found. There's a learning curve that describes the skill trajectory of world-class experts, whether the skill is physical or mental. And the way that you crawl up this learning curve is doing what Anders would call deliberate practice. Thousands and thousands of hours spread out over years. These individuals are very rare. Some of them attend Curtis Music Academy here in Philadelphia. Jane Golden is one of them. Mark Vetri is one of them. But there are not many, many people like that, because it is much easier to hang out on the plateau of arrested development. You get better in the beginning, just like the expert does. But when you are good enough, you stop trying. You're fine. There's nothing wrong with you, but you're not growing and learning. One of the people that I studied for this book was Bill McNabb, who runs Vanguard. And he said, you know, it's an interesting thing when I became a leader of a company like this. I used to think that I would be able to pick the individuals, the young men and women, who would really go far and make a contribution to this company. And you know what? I was wrong about the people that I picked. What turned out to be more important than I could have ever imagined is their relentless commitment to developing, learning, and growing. There are too many people who are content to be fine, to basically do things today the way they did them yesterday and last year. This, I think, really is most of us. And then finally, it's possible to drop out of something altogether, to stop cooking, to stop trying to speak French. Whatever complex human skill you can think of, when you drop out, your skills will regress to where they began, to zero. So before we turn to conversation with Jane, let me explain to you what I really mean by this kind of deliberate practice. It's what I think makes Jane so great. It's what I think makes Mark Vetri such a great chef. It's what makes Roberto Diaz a world-class violist. It only has four simple parts, and each of them are actually doable, but all of them done in combination, quite rare. The first is trying to do something you can't yet do. Of course you should be trying to do something that you can't yet do. When's the last time you really did that? Here's a trivial example. I go to Philly Power Yoga. It's quite good, on Chestnut Street near Rittenhouse Square. And sometimes my teacher will say to me, as she says to the rest of the class, well, you know, we're going to do tree pose, but why don't you close your eyes? And you're going to fall over because you can't balance with your eyes closed. But you know what? It's yoga, and we love you, so it doesn't matter. Nobody's laughing. Nobody closes their eyes. Nobody wants to do what they can't yet do. Nobody wants to do what they can't yet do. Or rare are those individuals, at the least. Once you have intentionally set aside one narrow aspect of your performance that you're going to work on, Roberto Diaz would say, it's working on the Achilles heel of the music. It's working on a weakness. Whatever it is that you can't yet do, that you've intended to work on, you must focus 100%. You must put full effort. There's a terrific little video that's up. It's Carnegie Hall's Practice, Practice, Practice. That's their tagline. How do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice, practice, practice. I think it started off as a joke, but you know, the musicians at Carnegie Hall were like, exactly, practice, practice, practice. And there's a video of a young musician. She's a cellist, and she says, you know, when I sit down to practice, if I'm tired and I know it's not going to go well, I don't practice because I don't want to reinforce bad habits. And if it's not the right time of day, but I've gotten a habit, I've gotten a routine, and I make sure that my cell phone's not in the same room, and I make sure that nobody's going to interrupt me. If you want to do deliberate practice like an expert, it's truly with full effort. Third is you need feedback. I mean, I don't really know what all of you do for a living, but most of you are not professional musicians. A musician can hear the feedback immediately. An athlete can see the feedback immediately. But what if you're an accountant? What if you run a mural arts program? What if you run a restaurant or you're a psychologist? How do you get feedback? I don't know, but you do. World-class experts find the feedback, often from a coach, a teacher, or a mentor, often from videotape, if that's appropriate. But feedback is essential for learning. And as a mother with two daughters in the Philadelphia public schools, I'll say this. It's a challenge for public school educators to give these kids feedback, because when you have to teach 180 of them in one day, it's very, very difficult to grade their essays or even their homework. That said, the gauntlet has been thrown down. The challenge for us is to find ourselves and our kids feedback so they can learn. And then finally, listening to the feedback, reflection. There was a terrific study of musicians done by university scholars who did something incredibly simple. What they did was they gave a large group of musicians the same music to learn. It was a new piece, so they all had the same shot. And then what they did was they listened to their practice. And at the very end of hours and hours of practice, they gave everybody a kind of recital, and they graded these musicians on how well they had progressed. And here's what they found. If you ask yourself, who are the musicians who performed the best at the end of this little test, the difference was entirely made by the quality of their practice. And this is what it sounded like. When a musician is doing deliberate practice, they play sometimes the same measure over and over again. So it doesn't really sound fun as a listener, because you're listening to this, you're not listening to the whole thing. And they're working on often the most difficult part of the piece, so it's the least fluent. And there are long pauses in the practice. And do you know why? During that pause, that musician is thinking about the feedback. They're reflecting. They're planning a refinement. And they're doing the whole thing over and over again. And here's the opposite of that. If your daughter or son is playing piano and it sounds great, it sounds fluent, because they're not working on a stretch goal, they're not working on a weakness, and it just sort of goes off as autopilot, and you clap loudly, then you are rewarding performance, but you're not rewarding practice. With those words, I'm going to ask Jane to come up here, and we're going to continue the conversation. I'd love to tell you a little bit more about my work by questioning Jane. I kind of, you know, rigged this a bit, because I've been studying her, and as she comes up here and we get the chairs out, I'll say something about how I got to know her. I'm not really an artist, and I don't know that I'd even call myself an art appreciator, certainly not at the level of some of the people in this room or Jane. But when I went around to, I can't tell you how many people, and I said, who's the grittiest person in Philadelphia? I don't care what they do for a living. Many more than I can count said, go talk to Jane Golden. One of the people who works at Mural Arts has said that working with Jane is like working the night before an election, but the election never comes. So I thought we'd start pretty easy, which is, and I know you've told me this before, but I don't know everybody knows. Just how did you get into Mural Arts? Because I think you originally wanted to be an artist, and one of the things that people ask me a lot is, well, where do I get one of those passions, right? I would have no problem following it if I actually had one. So maybe you could just tell a little bit of your story.
First of all, I just want to say I'm totally honored to be here tonight, so thank you.
Hugs.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. Very inspired by you. So, I mean, I...
Yeah, I know the mic is weird. Yeah.
So I always loved art. I started painting when I was really young. I had a mom who was a fantastic watercolor painter. Maybe we'll come back to that when I was little. I'm like sort of neurotic and full of angst, so that sort of like pushed me on. But then when I was at Stanford, I actually thought I was an artist who wanted to go to law school. And so when I graduated, I moved down to L.A. and saw these beautiful murals. And then I remembered my parents had talked to me a lot about painting murals and how much I had loved murals. And because murals make art available to everybody. You know, I just thought that theoretically. But these murals were beautiful. And so I ended up applying to the L.A. mural program for a grant. And they turned me down, like not once, like five times. And, you know, and I called them every day. I call them, like, every day. You see, like, the people... This is why the city of Philadelphia thinks I'm a pest. So, five mayors, we've made it through. So, I just called every day at 3. Finally, I got a call. I heard someone say... I get this call. Is Jane Golden there? I said, this is she. They said, we hope we never hear from you again. I'm like, oh, my God. Why such hostility? They said, well, you have the grant. Just please stop calling us. So, but I fell in love with mural painting. And that's, you know, it just sort of connected with all these things I had been interested in, like thinking about cities, government, education, art. It was just this really interesting integration of the different worlds I was sort of thinking about in my mind, traversing. But I hadn't really made that first step. But I didn't know how to do a mural. I really, with full disclosure, I lied on my application to the city of Los Angeles. I told them I had done murals all over Stanford's campus. I painted large. I thought that counted, sort of. And then I was like, oh, my God, I have the grant. The grant was $300 to do a wall 20 feet high, 100 feet long. I'm like, oh, what do I do? So I wrote the city of Chicago because they had a mural program. And I said, do you have anything that could teach me how to do murals? I'm about to paint one. And they sent me a little mural manual. I still have it. You know, it's sentimental. And I underlined, like, grid wall. So
you did it due to the grid.
So I did a grid, and it was just so thrilling. But I was very nervous.
So the thing is about becoming an art activist, right? I mean, mm-hmm. My own mother is an artist, and I think I can kind of appreciate that she's really driven by the need to create. You know, it doesn't even matter if people see her paintings. And when I started, you know, researching you, studying you as a subject, as a paragon of grit, I just was a little puzzled because art I can see as very creative and fulfilling in that way. But, you know, fighting with city council and, you know, the people who are, you know, going to sue you because they don't want a mural on their wall, or they don't like, you know, the fact that they won't be able to build something where there's a mural. Like, how is that creative? How is it, you know, one thing is about passion is that you have to not get bored with what you do. And how do you not get bored with, you know, this is, what year have you been doing this?
Like, I've been doing it a long time. Yeah. We became mural arts in 1997, 98.
So like, how are you not bored of all the red, you know, you don't even get to paint.
No, but I like love it. It's like, I really like love it because first of all, I think that beauty, there's so much power in beauty. And I think that I'm a kind of person, I really, and this is like true, I'm like not making this, I just see potential everywhere. Like I just came from the Philadelphia Award, and the woman who got the Philadelphia Award, she was talking about, so eloquently, about juvenile lifers, and I'm sitting there, my mind is like going, brrr, like I have all the, and I went up to her and said, oh my God, this is so great, I have so many ideas. Like, so it's like, but when I stopped painting murals, I mean, because I painted murals like a long time, like if you had met me back in the day, I was just covered with paint, and all these graffiti writers around me, and it was like, you're going to change the world through art. Like, we didn't know anything, but we just felt it. So, but then when mural art started to grow, it was a choice point. Like, and I just thought, quite honestly, you know, I'm an okay painter. I know really great artists, and like, we can really support them and support kids. And what if I could look at mural arts as a creative endeavor? And it was a really, I mean, and I would say that was not like some easy choice to make. But it was like, once I made it, see, this is the other thing, like, I locked into that. And then it was like, oh, wait a minute. We could have a program in education. We could work with the behavioral health system. We could work, you know, in criminal justice. Could think about community reinvestment. Suddenly, it was like this multiplier effect. And once, you know, to move the needle is so hard. But you, like, I think that our program has to be aspirational and completely pragmatic. And that ties into those two parts of my brain. Because we dream, but it's like, bottom line, what do Philadelphians want? Let's hit the ground running and make sure what we're doing works on behalf of citizens. And that's sort of just, I'm just locked into that. And I'm like my father used to say when I was little, like, I was like he used to say I was dogged, right? I was like a dog with a bone. Like, I just don't let go. And I just keep going. But the thing is, the world I'm in unfolds, and that sort of keeps me going.
Yeah, I think you're like the least bored person I know. That's really remarkable. So let me ask you one last question before we turn it over to you guys, and then you can ask us both questions, or like we can see. You know. But, you know, if someone said, wow, I want to be like half as dogged as you, right? Or maybe like an eighth as dogged as you, or just like a little more dogged, right? Like a little more resilient. You know, you get rejected a lot, right? I mean, you fight with people a lot. I cannot imagine. So what advice would you give to someone who says, oh, I want to do that, but I don't have that now?
But you have to develop it. It's like, you know, it's like a, you know, if you talked about musicians, it's sort of like, and this is what we try to, when we work with kids in our programs or people who are in prison or coming out of prison or in the, it's the same message. It's like to cultivate a virtuosity, right? Like it takes tenacity. There is nothing comes easily. It just
doesn't. How do you do it though? And I know that's not fair because I'm the psychologist, but I'm just going to ask.
How do you do it? You do it by just absolutely just, you sort of choose this path and then you stay on it. I think it's a very conscious choice because it is not easy. You know, when I was diagnosed with lupus and told you're not going to live long, it was easy to give in.
You did that like a total parenthetical, like, oh, by the way, when I was diagnosed with lupus and told I was going to die, right? Could you maybe just like double click on that like once? Okay.
So,
it's a really good story.
So,
and it's, yeah.
So, you know, it was like so depressing to suddenly at a young age have to grapple with your mortality. And it was like, oh, you know, I can't believe it. Like, and then it was, I just thought, well, a couple things happened. Well, first, this nurse came in and said, I have lupus, and you just can't listen to that doctor. You just can't give into it. And I thought that tape that played in my head from the time I was little, that like led me to sort of keep painting even and entering competitions. And when I lost competitions, I would just be a sort of a sour sport about it and then work harder the next year and just keep working. I had a spy club and, you know, I challenged everyone to live up to like my, like whatever, my rules of the spy. Like I was so, whatever I did, I was so tenacious. And I thought to myself, like, that is somewhere in the back of my mind and I have to draw on that. I have to choose to live. Like that was just a choice. And when I started working for the Anti-Graffiti Network, it was a gift. It was such a gift to have access to neighborhoods, to meet community leaders, to meet people who were tenacious and driven too, right? And it was all about survival. All of us had something in common, even though we were different, and it was extraordinary. And I thought, I am going to choose to live. And then I got it when we work with people who are struggling with addiction or depression or trauma. It's totally not easy. It is completely hard, and I come from a privileged life of two great parents and lots of opportunities, and I get that, right? But I also get I could never just give in or be complacent or be not grateful or gracious every moment. And so everybody around us that we work with, it's like, can you make that choice? Can you stay on the path? Can you sort of believe in yourself so that change can happen? And that's the kind of tenacity and that we want to sort of get, you know, sort of tap into that tenacity. But there's something that I see in people, and that is this word that I completely love, and that is resilience, right? It's like grit. And sort of, I think it sort of lies, like mine is here, but it can sometimes lie hidden. And I think we try to sort of mine it for people and to put it to work in a really positive way. Because it can be life-changing.
Right. Thank you. Okay, so hands up. I'm going to point to that gentleman there who's standing up. And then there's a mic. Yeah.
So my sense is, Jane, that you're a world-class gritter. And I don't think I'm a world-class gritter, but I believe...
That's like the opposite of a quitter, is a gritter. I think you just made up a word. It's awesome. It's a world-class
so
gritter.
So let me finish, please.
Sorry.
So here I'm coming
please.
Back at you. I'm coming back at you. I'm really getting annoyed. So I believe, and it just occurred to me sitting down there, that you can create a culture of making people grittier. I believe you can create a culture. And I also believe that grit has to be associated with joy. There's got to be a quality of joy, or you're not going to stick with it. You have joy.
Yes.
I have joy in what I do. I do things I don't really want to do, but I do them because I believe in my what I'm in it for. So joy, community, role models, it can be done.
And positive feedback. I completely agree with you.
Yeah, I do too. I have to say that I think that culture is the most profound influence upon us. You know, I mean, you get off the plane in another country, you pretty much start doing the things that the other people do because you landed in their culture and you're human.
So you said the grit scale, that first slide you showed, is one of the best predictors of people's success. But is there like a self-reporting issue there? Like to me, it seems like there's clearly right answers. So...
Yeah, the grit scale. Oh, I thought of a new way of doing the questions. Whoever has the mic, why don't you just pick somebody, because I can't see anything anyway. So, okay, for this question, though, I'll just say this. So the grit scale is ridiculous. I mean, I am a hard worker. 5 out of 5, right? I mean, I finish whatever I begin. It's completely fakeable, right? And that's, there's another problem. I mean, not just fakeable. I mean, you can get a perfect score without thinking too hard. But the other thing about it, which makes it highly imperfect, is that if you're like Jane and you're thinking, what does it mean to work hard, right? Like, how many hours a week do you work?
I work like endlessly.
But like just really, like, count them, like just in your head.
Okay. So there's a week is 40 hours, and so I work, I start work, I hop out of bed at 6.
I bet you do hop out of bed at 6.
I hop, like, then I have to walk. I know, I was just in Cuba, and I was leading this community meeting, and I was so excited, I jumped, and that's the universal sign of joy. Everyone's like, she jumped, in Spanish, they said, which I don't really understand, but I was trying
really
hard.
So you got joy, yeah.
So, but then I work.
So 6 in the
morning.
Then
I come, I guess everyone here is going to think, like, okay, so.
No, you're,
but I, so then I, then at night, I start to work again, so then I probably work till midnight.
Right, every day.
Every day. And then on Saturdays, if there's like a Saturday and I don't have a lot of work, well then I like, it's sort of a strange feeling. Like, we have a lot of, Mural Arts has a million events, which is good. It's like my brother says, you've created your spy club at Mural Arts.
Because
like,
you're
that's
like,
right.
No, you have something to do.
So it's, you know, so, but then I find things to do. And I'd like, you know, I just like to stay busy. I teach at Penn. I teach at Moore.
So when you think, I am a hard worker, you probably have a mental image of what it is to be a hard worker.
Yeah.
And that might not be the same mental image, the same standard, the same what psychologists call frame of reference as other people. Because they are fakeable, these questionnaires that psychologists use, because they are subject to people's subjective standards, I don't think they can be used for high-stakes things like college admissions. I don't think they should be used for grading schools on grit or teachers. There are a bajillion other reasons why you shouldn't do that anyway. But I do think they're useful for two things. When I collect data on thousands of individuals who have no incentive to fake because their data just gets sucked into a database, and all the error sort of averages out, and you're just looking for a pattern, right? I'm just looking for a correlation. Then I can use that fakeable, transparent, ridiculous scale for research, and it works okay. And the other thing I think it's useful for, I'll say this. So, you know, Jane has a lot of insight into her own, you know, way of being, but young people often don't. And sometimes I meet teachers, and in particular, I'll tell you a story of a coach. Anson Dorrance is the coach of the UNC Tar Heel women's soccer team, the winningest soccer team in history. And he gives the grit scale just as a self-reflection, not to penalize any of the girls, not to promote any of the girls, but just so that when you read a question like, I finish whatever I begin, for a few seconds you can think about it and you know, just reflect on whether you do or you don't, whether you want to or you don't. So I think the scale is great for research. I think it's great for self-reflection. I really don't think it's good for anything else.
I'm wondering, when you were first discussing this, when you were talking about children and their characteristics, as an adult, is this something that you can learn? And is it teachable?
Yeah, here I'm gonna come right out here on stage at the Philadelphia Public Library and say that I think almost anything can be practiced and learned. I'm not saying that I can turn you into Roberto Diaz or Mark Vetri, right? I'm not saying that, like, anybody could be Jane Golden or, you know, we could all be Mozart. I'm not saying that anybody could be anything. I'm just saying that any positive characteristic, generosity, emotional intelligence, good writer, all these things can be practiced. I mean, why not, really? And why would things stop growing and changing when you're 22, 32, or 42? When I went to college, I was a neurobiology major, and I was taught that the brain is essentially fixed at a certain young age. A lot of brain development in early childhood, and then you just get, like, frozen, right? And then you just use that brain and hope it lasts for the rest of your life. That's not what is taught in neuroscience classes today. We now know, that we didn't before, that the brain is plastic, malleable, for the entire lifespan. And if you look at plots of personality, my own mother said once to me, and I couldn't believe it, that she was a very shy girl growing up. I mean, I couldn't believe it. I was like, you could not possibly have been shy. You could talk to the president and, like, eat off his plate. There's no way you were shy. And she was, because if you look at graphs of personality, they too change over time. So I'm not saying that everybody in this room is going to walk out a 5 out of 5 on grit. I don't think this room necessarily wants that. But I think that you can learn to develop your interests. You can develop a capacity for deliberate practice. You can develop a sense of purpose in your life, as Jane has. And resilience, which you so eloquently underscored, there's a science of resilience, there are habits of resilience, there are beliefs of resilience, and all of them can be practiced and taught.
I started working with the graffiti writers. You know, our first project was the Spring Garden Street Bridge, and Wilson Good said, if you finish this, and someone said, oh my God, it wasn't great art, but we were joyful. And the graffiti writers, he was like, you can get a full-time job if you can complete this in 3 weeks. I'm like, we're completing this in 3 weeks. I think Tim Spencer was like, oh my God, like we were out there till like 11 o'clock with flashlights. And all these kids are like, what is going on? And people like rode on the bridge, people stole our supplies. And I'm like, we're doing it. This ship is not turning around. And all these kids were like, oh my God, we're doing it. And suddenly they got caught up in it. All those years of anti-graffiti, we went up 2 steps and back 20 steps. But I think it's up to us adults to set up these, when we set up opportunities for young people or whomever we're working with, to be really intentional to try to cultivate that. Because I believe, and I believe this with all my heart after so many years of doing this work, that it's there. That we can find that genius, that strength, that potential that has gone unrecognized. And we can grab onto it and use it as a lifeline.
So do you see why I study her, by the way? It's like, how could I not study Jane Golden? Like, yeah, all the answers are right here.
Hi. I should preface with the fact that I am a millennial studying education. So I've read a lot of researchers and practitioners in education who have argued pretty strongly against grit in schools. So two of the ones that I would really love to hear you speak about are the fact that students are given goals that are not their goals, that they really don't care about. And it's easy to just dismiss that as not having enough grit. And the second one is in the context of students who are growing up in poverty, who have a lot of outside influences that might impact their resilience, their grit. So what would you say to those criticisms?
Those are two excellent questions to bring up, and they give me an opportunity to clarify my position. Not necessarily to make it all clear that I have all the answers and that I'm right. So the first thing that you said is, what about whose goals? That big question. And maybe grit is just another word for compliance, you know? Like, as one of my collaborators, Dave Levin, who started the KIPP Charter School, said, sometimes when we say to kids that we want them to do things for their own good, we really mean sit down and shut up. And, you know, there's a good argument to be made that this message can be misinterpreted that way. But I mean grit as pursuing goals that you find interesting and you find meaningful in that they're important to other people that you care about. If they're my goals, not your goals, then it's not grit, really. Now, I say that, but I don't believe that kindergartners should decide at the age of 5 whether they should or shouldn't take math. You know, I believe that there's some things that grown-ups should just say, look, you know what, learn how to write and learn how to read and learn how to do a little math, and you don't have to major in it, but, you know, you do have to bend a little bit. And I think one developmental psychologist said that growing up was, you know, sort of an act of violence because, you know, you have this kid and they want to do this and they have to conform, and they do. To some extent, to society. But when I study paragons of grit like Jane Golden or Roberto Diaz, nobody's telling Jane Golden to wake up at 6 a.m. and get out of bed. Nobody tells Roberto Diaz that he has to practice his viola, right? At a mature stage, a paragon of grit is deeply intrinsically motivated. And for that reason, when schools say to me, Dr. Duckworth, we're going to have grit week, and we're having all the kids try to increase their standardized test scores, I say, I love you so much, comma, but I'm not sure that this is the goal that 17-year-olds, 14-year-olds, 11-year-olds are passionate about. So that's one concern, and I think that I have, I stay up at night not sleeping because of that. When every time I get one of those emails, I'm just like in a panic, and I try to visit as many schools as I can to correct my own views on this or to make sure the message that I want to deliver is clear. The second question you asked is really important, and that's about whether grit becomes an excuse for poverty and inequality. Because you can imagine someone who says, those poor kids who don't look like me, who don't do very well, it's their fault because they're not gritty enough, right? I've got, like, another reason to not spend money on schools. I have another reason to not care about teaching quality. I have another reason to not worry about the income gap. And I'll tell you who I just emailed about it today. I emailed Ta-Nehisi Coates. And if you haven't read Between the World and Me, you have to read Between the World and Me. It's like, it's, I mean, you can agree with it or not, but it's just so beautifully written. And the reason I emailed him originally, which was while I was writing the book, is I said, dear Ta-Nehisi, it's taken a hell of a lot of grit to get your email address. And if you write me back, I'd like to know if I can take your words really on writing. I was actually trying to quote him, not on poverty and race issues, but on writing. In his acceptance for the MacArthur, he said, writing is seeing your horribleness on the page and waking up again and working at it till it's not bad, and on and on and on. And I rewrote his words as a poem. So my original email to him was just asking permission if I could take the words that came out of his mouth and just write them the way I heard them. But I felt it would be an invasion of his writing to do that without his... But here's the last email I sent him. I was like, dear Ta-Nehisi, it's only day 3 of book tour and I am exhausted. I feel like hamburger meat, but I'm still awake at night thinking about something, and it's people who ask me about poverty and grit. I don't see them as opposites, as in the following. I don't see that a concern with grit and with character means that you don't care about poverty. I think it's a false fight to say that there's opportunities on the one hand and there's character on the other. And I've said this to him before in our email exchanges. So I said to him that we should write a New York Times op-ed together because we should really think and write this out. But I'll tell you what he said to me in earlier emails. He said, I tell my kid that he needs to learn how to work hard too. And I think you probably say the same thing to your daughters. And we also say to our kids that this is a very unfair place, the world, and you have an opportunity to make things better. So, in other words, I don't think it's either or. I really, really, really care about the schools in this city, and it is a crime how much privilege some few kids have in the city and the lack of privilege that the vast majority do. But at the same time, I will go to schools and say to teachers, I think that we should figure out how to teach kids work ethic and help them develop their passion. And I don't see an inconsistency. Here's his reply. I'll think about it. So there's hope.
Great presentations from both of you. It's a follow-up to that question. For people who come from really wealthy or privileged backgrounds, so might be going to schools that offer them everything, do you think in any way they're disadvantaged for grit because they don't really ever have to pick up their pieces compared to people in much more challenging circumstances, including poverty?
So, Jane, you said that you came from privilege. I mean, I did too, right? I mean, Cherry Hill Public Schools is not exactly coming from disadvantage. You know, I grew up on a cul-de-sac. You grew up in... Your family's pretty wealthy.
I grew up in Margate.
Margate, like, you know, pretty... And educated, right? Because it's not only material advantage, but my parents were educated. Your parents were educated.
Yes.
Also, my parents were, like, reasonably... reasonably capable, like, just laughing there because there were a few memories that went through my head. But yeah, they, you know, they fed and clothed me, and they were very loving. I always knew my parents loved me. I mean, you can't really make, you know, much of a conclusion from two people telling you their stories, but I would say that at least there's evidence here, and I can give you a little more, right? But that it's not that if you grow up with a lot of advantages and you go to a good schools and people are nice to you and you have a good coach and, you know, you have, like, kale for dinner and, you know, like, it's not that that, I think, is going to abolish your grit. I really don't. I think there is this theory that you have to suffer to be gritty. I do think you need to be challenged to be gritty. You have to try things that you can't do, and you have to fail sometimes, and you have to screw up, and you have to take 20 steps back.
Right.
But that's a different thing from being impoverished or unloved or abused. And I think what I found consistently in my data, but also if you look at the parenting literature, and one of the last library events that I attended was Larry Steinberg, who wrote The Age of Opportunity. And he is, you know, a world-class adolescent researcher and an expert on parenting. Larry, when he was the president of a society of adolescent researchers, said, you know, if there's one thing that adolescent researchers have figured out that is bedrock solid, it is that parents who are supportive of their children but also provide challenges, this combination of loving but appropriately tough, right? It is the combination that makes kids happy and healthy growing up. And it seems to also be the crucible of grit. So I don't want adversity for anyone's kids, but I do want challenge for everyone's kids, and I absolutely want support for them.
It was about not giving up. It was always to have humility. Like my father, I hear my father's voice in my head to be gracious and humble. Like you don't have all the answers. You have to like always like surround yourself with other people who know more than you do. I mean, as a young person, like these were like important messages. And so, you know, there are times when, you know, like I took summer programs at Tanglewood for, you know, for painting and when I was in college. And it was hard. It was impossible. I was with all art school students who were so much better than I was, right? And we had tough New York painters as the teachers. And, like, they just were abusive. They would just yell at me. And this one guy would go, "Golden!" And go, "Yes, yes." And finally, at the end, he goes, "You know what?" He said, "You don't have as much talent as some of the people in here." This was just what he said. He said, "But you have more grit." Is what the word he used.
Did?
And tenacity. And you'll find your way. And I was just like, I hate art. You know, and I went home and I said, I'm never going to paint again. And my parents are like, of course you're going to paint again. You know, and as a muralist, like some of the murals were like, you know, when we had to hear critiques of the murals, I mean, you're vulnerable as a public artist. It's very hard. And so how do you learn to fail forward? And how do you sort of teach other people like that? Failure is not the end of it. Like, it's just, you just have to hold on to it and keep moving forward. And I think it's a trick. I think it's like an art form. But I think it's something that you want to master. And that's part of the, so when I said it's a sort of the virtuosity of trying to learn this world of grit, of resilience, of staying on a track and moving forward.
Dr. Duckworth, thank you so much for your presentation. My question for you is, with regards to the question that one of the listeners here asked about cultivating and teaching grit to our students, and then you mentioning about the brain is plastic and malleable, I can't help but think about the work by Professor Carol Dweck at Stanford on growth mindset. I was wondering if you've collaborated with her, because I just see so many parallels between your work and her work.
Carol wrote me an email on Wednesday of last week. We had just co-taught a seminar. I was virtual. I was Skyping in to Stanford, and I was just about to go on book tour. And, you know, as a scientist, I have a deep ambivalence about actually writing a book. Like, we're really not supposed to do that. We're supposed to write these, like, very dry, incredibly precise articles with no metaphors and no stories and no Jane Goldens. And I kind of felt like, ugh, I did that thing that scientists do. They went and wrote a book about what they know. And Carol sent me this email on Wednesday that said, "I really admire what you're doing." I mean, it wasn't a long email. Of course, I reread it, you know, 17 times. Because I think it's important, you know. And here's what I'll say about our work together. For those of you who don't know Carol Dweck, she's a Stanford psychologist who has discovered that we all walk around with theories of the world, theories of how the world works, theories of human nature. You can have a growth mindset theory, which is that deep down you believe in malleability and change. I mean, you're like Jane. Some of you might be like, she's nuts. She's crazy, right? Like, to have that kind of hope that people are going to change, like, especially with the, you know, communities that you're working, I mean, you're not working in places where, like, hope is just, you know, easily obvious, right? Carol would say that Jane has a growth mindset, but she would say that there's another way of looking at the world, a theory that says people are who they are.
You know, like, these kids who are just so annoying in the classroom, they will always be annoying in the classroom. It's a fixed mindset because you believe that things don't really change. And Carol will tell you that each of these theories proves themselves right. Each of these theories is internally consistent. So you can go through your entire life with one theory or the other, consistently discovering evidence that you were right in the first place. Here's what we find in our work together. Children and adults who have a growth mindset about change, and that is the bedrock of hope. It's not like, oh, it's going to be sunny tomorrow. It's that I can do something here. That is the bedrock of hope psychologically. We find that individuals of any age who have a growth mindset are more likely to be gritty. Those gritty individuals work harder. They put in deliberate practice. They don't give up. They don't drop out when you take 20 steps back. And that pays off in objective things like grades, but more importantly, college persistence and career success. So I think we should end this evening in homage to folks like Carol Dweck, herself a paragon of passion and perseverance for what she does, and Mark Vetri and Roberto Diaz, and maybe most of all, Jane Golden and the Mural Arts Program. Thank you so much for your time and your attention tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.